Welcome back to another episode of Inside SFPS. My name is Cody Donarski, Public Information Officer with Santa Fe Public Schools. And today I am joined by a very special guest. Today I am joined by Dr. Alan Lucero, who is a computer science teacher at Milagro Middle School. Thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, good morning and thank you for inviting.
Of course, I am very excited about this. My wife, who does a lot of the SPG stuff with the district, has spoken very highly about you throughout her time with the district, and I've heard a lot of really great things about you and your career and kind of how you've gotten to this point, so I'm very excited. So let's jump in. So you are not a New Mexico native, correct?
Not quite.
Not quite?
Lots of family here and lots of history here, but I was born and raised in New York.
In New York? What part of New York?
Staten Island, before the bridge, and so there were farms and horses all over the place.
Before the
in
dump?
In New York, yes.
Was it before the dump?
Yes, but before the bridge specifically, because that allowed commuters.
Of course. And so when you were in Staten Island and kind of growing up, going to school, did you have an idea of what you wanted to do when you grew up?
I was interested in biology, and that took a turn after like a first run in college. I was interested in research. I worked in a tissue culture laboratory for a while, but I just became more and more interested in the harder sciences, so to speak.
What do you mean harder sciences? What does that?
Well, I could say that the college that I was attending at that time was very pointed towards pre-med for anybody that was in any of the biological sciences. And I didn't feel, just at a gut level, comfortable working with living things. I mean, they're interesting to me, but I needed to get right down to the core of, you know, what was really happening at the atomic level. And that's where my interests went.
What school did you go to?
So it was Manhattan College when I had this first attempt. And then I won't say take a break because it was not a break. It was some seriously hard construction work that I did for a number of years working as an electronics engineer and as an electrician before that. And then I decided to go all the way. I was working, putting in the new, at the time, communication system at UNM in the early 80s and decided that was the place for me. And I did my undergraduate work there at in Albuquerque.
So you did your undergraduate at UNM. Is that what brought you out here or?
Oh, no. I had moved back. As I said, lots of family here. My dad's family came into what is now called the state in 1617.
Oh, wow.
And I have traces all the way, you know, solid trace all the way back to there. But my dad was in the Navy during World War II and just settled in New York. So we visited a lot and I always remained homesick for Santa Fe.
That's awesome. So when you graduated or when you left undergraduate at UNM, what was your first job out of college? What did you do when you left?
Out of UNM, it was back to graduate school. I had been working a weekend job through my professor as a senior at Los Alamos. Met a professor there from the University of Connecticut. We clicked. I liked his research. And so I did my graduate work at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut.
And what were you studying? Like what was your specific study or research or what you had done when you were at UConn?
The most broad way to say it is the interaction of light and matter. I just found that fascinating that you can study what's going on at that level, at the atomic level, by observing the interaction of it and light.
That's fascinating. And then when you left graduate school, where did you go?
Yeah, so as I was finishing up my undergraduate work at UNM, I won the AT&T Bell Laboratories Graduate Fellowship. And so AT&T not only paid for my graduate work plus a stipend, I also got the even more advantageous opportunity to intern with them during my summers, and that led to a postdoctoral position right after my 6 years at the University of Connecticut.
Oh, wow. Is that in Connecticut?
University of Connecticut is in Storrs, right in the center. My internship and then postdoctoral work was in Crawford Hill, New Jersey, which, as I mentioned to one of your colleagues, that's where Penzias and Wilson discovered the background radiation from the Big Bang.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that antenna is still there.
That's fascinating. Did you, when you were there, are you able to talk about what you were doing while you were working
sure.
for the labs?
Later on, I did stuff for the government, and we'll leave that at that.
Yep.
The work that I did led to, it was like right at the beginning of the explosion in optical communications, where we no longer send our voice and our videos and our images and our text over copper wires. We send it as pulses of light through optical fibers. And so I was right there at the beginning of that.
So you kind of came through the big technology boom as cell phones were really taking off and all these other devices and things.
Exactly. And beyond cell phones, probably the majority of my career was designing and improving systems that took signals transoceanic. So we put down a lot of cables between Long Island and England, between Long Island and Ireland, between Florida and South America. And then I would be deployed to these places to test these new fiber optic cables as they were installed. And that was a lot of fun.
How do you do that? And like the simplest way to ask the question, how does fiber optic cable run transatlantic?
Because it's not flat.
Yeah.
There are volcanoes and there are chasms and mountains. So there are a string of engineering ships which map a route. Then the ship that actually lays the cable is an engineering marvel. They have to lay the cable at a rate. Remember, this is 4 miles deep. And so this cable is slowly drifting down. They have to make sure that there's no pulls, there are no twists. It's just an incredibly ballet of a process. So it's laid from end to end, but of course, no light is going to travel 6,000 miles without fading out. And so here's where my specialty was. Approximately every 30 miles for a transoceanic distance, we would install what's in the cable, what's called an optical amplifier. So we use light to amplify light. And that was my big specialty. That's where my book chapter is in most of my my papers come in, the development of these optical amplifiers. If you think of a audio amplifier, which you use all the time,
yes,
you're amplifying an audio signal with transistors and electrical power. And so it's not dissimilar. There's a process where you could amplify light with light.
That's so incredible. And was that kind of revolutionary at that time? Or
big? Big revolutionary, yes. I mean, before optical fibers, the copper wires that took signals across the oceans were operating in the megahertz. That's millions of bits per second. And by the time I left, and we're talking 2014, so it's a while now, by the time I left, we were doing many, many hundreds of billions of bits per second, and that's in one fiber. Usually there's a bundle of eight fibers, so there's trillions of bits per second traveling back and forth. And if you think about it, you know, it's our fault. We Google, and, our answer may come from their servers in New York, or it may come from Ireland. It just bounces wherever a server is needed. And so all of these bits are flying back and forth. They're all our information, our voice, our questions, our silly Instagram pictures.
That's
and they're just, you know.
And that technology is still existing?
Oh, yeah. And building.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So that you said you were finished with your work there in 2014?
2014, yeah. There was a massive downsizing. Mm-hmm. It was bloody. Probably 50% of a building of 250 people were laid off in one day. And my wife and I took less than a minute to say, okay, we're moving home to New Mexico.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And so when you moved back, was your plan to go back to a national laboratory? What was kind of your plan when you got back here?
The plan was to retire. We had already purchased a little piece of property just north of town. I took about a year to design it on my own. I learned how to use design software. And then when it was built, what am I going to do now? So I met a few people that were doing volunteer work, joined up with them. There's a couple of organizations, and they're still active in town. Took a shot at teaching high school, but I didn't feel like it was a really good fit for me. Went back to volunteer work. And it was as I was doing that that I realized that a couple of schools in town were so low in teaching staff that kids were going with subs for months at a time. So I got a sub license just to help out with that. And really, this was the linchpin. A previous assistant principal here at Milagro asked me to put together a computer science course. And then there was no one to teach it, so I got my license.
So I think the work that gets done in this classroom is very important. When I was in high school, I took the Project Lead the Way pathway, which was the engineering pathway. So this kind of stuff is right up my alley. We didn't have anything like this, though. And I graduated in 2012, so I'm 11, what will probably be 12 years removed this school year from being in high school. So I'm not that far separated from a lot of these kids in this technology. But what these kids are doing at their age is what I would call remarkable. Because when I came into your classroom yesterday and I saw kids with lines of code on their computers, I was like, I'm still learning when I go onto the district website, when I see code, like what it all means. Talk about some of the work that the kids are doing in your class.
Yep. Well, first of all, I make sure that the kids just drop any inhibitions about being able to learn code. I make it really easy from their first code, and then anytime a new concept is introduced, I give them literally what they have to type. It's just imitation. And then within a couple of imitations, they start creating. I could give you some examples of that, but that's the principle. I give them a bicycle, and then they learn to do tricks. And you know, it's you know, they're doing things probably what used to be considered at the high school level. But the majority of these guys, some of them go, this is hard, just because they don't want to put their fingers on the keyboard. But the ones that do, they're flying, and they find it easy and fun. They're doing creative stuff. Quick example, because we mentioned before the mics went on about social-emotional learning, a project that I'm right in the middle of right now is they just learned how to process text in what could be comical ways. What code used to produce multiplication tables by repetition, they can now do repetitive words. And so what I did was I gave them a list of emotionally uplifting words, and they threw those into their code, and they're taking the output and putting them into colorful posters. And we're going to put those all around the room. So they're going to have their product of their code after only 3.5 weeks of work decoratively up on our room.
That's incredible. Are they learning HTML, Python, what?
So, yes, Python is the vehicle that I chose to teach them computer science for the first semester. It's very English-like. In fact, today, when they come in, I'm going to have them write English phrases and sentences and then show them that's exactly the next concept in Python that we're going to be attacking. It is a very powerful language, but it's easy to start, and it's very popular, and employers like if you understand Python.
It makes me so happy that kids are able to do this, because when I was growing up, even thinking about coding was like next level stuff. Like, you had to be a borderline genius to be able to code something like a website or something like that.
Not true.
and seeing the way that the kids maneuver it and how creative they get, and, you know, seeing, you know, like Barbara T's class at Capitol High, who's doing, you know, even more coding languages, seeing what they produce and how fast they can fly through it, it's exciting to see. and see kids gravitate towards it and see this as an opportunity for them in a career and a job and whatever they want to do in their life moving forward.
Yeah, I'm trying to, you know, drop hints here and there, get these guys excited about the program that's going on in the school we feed to, Santa Fe High. There are two women there teaching engineering courses. There is a guy who literally built the four-year program at Santa Fe High, and they teach a broad variety of things. I mean, Mr. Smith is having them build apps for their phones, program robotics, log on to the Amazon supercomputers. Amazon makes some of their supercomputers available for students. Yeah, so there's a lot going on at Santa Fe High, and they over there are really stoked about how here at Milagro we're integrating with them and making sure that our kids have a foundation to do their work when they get there.
And I think it's really important to highlight some of maybe the other skills that kids learn through computer science and the coding that they do. Like, obviously, you're learning the coding language and how to build things and stuff. But what are some of probably the, I guess, would be called the more intangible skills that they're learning that, you know, can translate to other aspects of their life?
Yeah, that's actually at the foundation of my philosophy in designing this course. I mentioned the word vehicle before. The computer language is just the vehicle to learn these cognitive skills. I want them to be able to think critically. I want them to be able to look at a complex idea and be able to disassemble it into its building blocks. I'd like them to be able to learn to plan and not just, okay, here's this project for today, but here's this project for the next 2 weeks, and, you know, collaborate with each other to put together a project that's meaningful, a report that really looks good, as well as, you know, be educational to their audience.
For some of the kids that might not be thinking about computer science, they might not think it's for them or might not be a good fit. What would be your argument to that?
Sure. I mean, someone that might be interested in business, I tell them that that's excellent. That's a wonderful career, but you're probably going to have to be talking and collaborating with people who are doing design work, and they will be working with people who are, you know, computer scientists or computer engineers. And so it's nice to be able to at least have their vocabulary and their mode of thinking. And even in business, I mean, project management is a big part of business, and project management is a little bit of what they're going to get in this course, how to collaborate with people.
What has been your favorite project to do with the kids? And maybe it's not your personal favorite, but the one where maybe the light bulbs go off in the kids' heads, or it's the one where, like, it connects the dots for kids. What's kind of the big project that you look forward to every year?
Yeah, as we roll through the next couple of weeks, they get more and more sophisticated tools. Then they're going to be working with data, and then they're going to be graphing data. And one of the aspects of Python is that it has a very, very powerful graphing package that they can access with only a few lines of code. And so I give them every approximately November thousands of lines of data from NOAA's satellites, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, which has been taking measurements of sea level since 1992. So here the kids have 30 years of data, and they're able to, you know, by November, with a few lines of code, plop it into a very professional-looking graph. So that's part one. That's the real technical part. Then I have them do research. In an introduction, I have them look up websites that talk about the causes and connections between climate change and sea level rise. Then we get less technical during the closing arguments. I have them, to make it personal for them, I have them look up how climate change might be impacting either their family locally or family where, you know, they may have come from another country or another region. Or if they don't want to do that, I give them the opportunity to just look up any area of the world that's interesting to them. And look at how those people are being impacted, but also how people are seeking solutions. Right? There are different cultures that are have different approaches to, you know, mitigating climate change. And so by the time they're done, this is a pretty good looking report. I make it, you know, building block for them. I put like tables, blank tables in for them where they could put their paragraphs and tables where they could drop in their own graphs. So it's there's some handholding involved, but when they're done, it's a good looking report.
I'm thinking I'm going to talk to Georgia when we're done and see if I can get enrolled in your class somehow.
Well, thank you.
That's something I could see kids doing in like a science class, but it's and computer science. I get that, but it's such a unique way to look at it and do it, and it makes me excited that our kids are coming up and are able to be exposed to something like this. That, you know, like I said, 12 years ago, I had no option in doing this, and that was in a high school level 12 years ago. When I was in middle school, you know, 16 years ago, this was not even a thing. Yeah. We still had computers that would roll in. Like computer labs weren't really a thing. Like we had laptops that rolled in to class, and that's how we used computers.
Yeah. Well, seventh graders have a very small world. And I'm really happy if I could, you know, open up a couple of windows in different directions so that they could see that, you know, you don't just grow up to be, you know, this or that career that they may have heard of, that there's so much going on. And I'd like to be able to open up that opportunity for them.
I think that's fantastic. I think that any kid who has even thought about computer science or coding or anything around technology to learn it, I think even in my career path, you know, I started in video and move to this role, which incorporates a lot more than just video, pictures, podcasts, audio, communications, everything like that. And working on the district website, coding is even important for me. And while I work with a company who hides a lot of code on their end, that, you know, they make it very user-friendly, there's still plenty of opportunities for me where I'm like, I wish I knew, I wish I could understand, I wish I had a better understanding of what's going on. And even with their simple knowledge of it, they can probably look at some of the code that I'm looking at and at least be able to tell me, oh, this is this and this is that and this is what this does and so on and so forth. And to be 14 years old, 13 years old when they come in here,
13, 14,
to be able to look at a few lines of code and be able to decipher it is pretty incredible. I really appreciate you taking the time this morning to speak with me. I know you're about to head off to a class here in a couple of minutes, so I really am appreciative and grateful that you took time to sit down and speak with me today. We're going to end the podcast with two questions. The first question comes from the We Are Not Strangers game that I've been asking our last few guests. The question that I have for you today is, what would be one thing that your younger self would not believe about yourself today?
My younger self was obsessive about research. It wasn't that I wasn't people-oriented because, you know, I was working in engineering research firms and I communicated daily and weekly to my management about progress and so on and collaborated with my colleagues. But teaching just didn't occur to me then. I had wonderful experiences with my own teachers and professors, but never considered myself to be an educator. And then first through the volunteer group and then actually having contact with teaching, it absolutely thrills me when I see light bulbs go on. And that happens a lot, I'm happy to say. It's just a thrill for me to see a kid not just quote-unquote get it about something, but enjoy getting it and just really feel proud of themselves.
I love that. And while you're speaking about having a good experience with teachers and professors, the last question that I asked to end the podcast is, what is the best piece of advice or guidance that you've ever received from a teacher or a mentor?
This is a nutshell version of it, but promote your own curiosity. Just be curious about stuff. And I would do this consciously sometimes. I would just stay so focused on one topic. And then, you know, I've got to broaden out a little bit. And, you know, an advantage in the type of career I had was that I would often go to conferences, and there would be so much cross-fertilization by meeting other scientists and engineers. And I guess that's kind of what all of the staff here are doing to these kids now. They're getting a broad array, not just in their core subjects, but we've got some great stuff going on in the art classes, our music. I could go on and on about some of our music teachers. Yeah, so the kids here are getting a really great cross-fertilization. I hope they take advantage of it.